they discussed the affairs of Prussia and Austria in that spirit. They divided Turkey in anticipation. They arranged for the conquest of India, and indeed of most of Asia, and that Russia should take Finland from the Swedes. And they disregarded the disagreeable fact that the greater part of the world's surface is sea, and that on the seas the British fleets sailed, now unchallenged. Close at hand was Poland, ready to rise up and become the passionate ally of France, had Napoleon but willed it so. But he was blind to Poland. It was a day of visions without a vision. Napoleon, even then, it seems, concealed the daring thought that he might one day marry a Russian princess, a real princess. But that, he was to learn in 1810, was going a little too far. After Tilsit, there was a perceptible deterioration in Napoleon's quality. He became rasher, less patient of obstacles, more and more the fated master of the world, more and more intolerable to everyone he encountered. In 1808, he committed a very serious blunder. Spain was his abject ally, completely under his control, but he saw fit to depose its Bourbon king in order to promote his brother Joseph from the crown of the two Sicilies. Portugal he had already conquered, and the two kingdoms of Spain and Portugal were to be united. Thereupon the Spanish arose, in a state of patriotic fury, surrounded a French army at Belen, and compelled it to surrender. It was an astonishing break in the French career of victory. The British weren't slow to seize the foothold this insurrection gave them. A British army under Sir Arthur Wellesley, afterwards the Duke of Wellington, landed in Portugal, defeated the French at Vimiero, and compelled them to retire into Spain. The news of these reverses caused a very great excitement in Germany and Austria, and the Tsar assumed a more arrogant attitude towards his ally. There was another meeting of these two potentates at Erfurt, in which the Tsar was manifestly less amenable to the dazzling tactics of Napoleon than he had been. Followed 4 years of unstable ascendancy for France, while the outlines on the map of Europe waved about like garments on a clothesline on a windy day. Napoleon's personal empire grew by frank annexations to include Holland, much of western Germany, much of Italy, and much of the eastern Adriatic coast. But one by one, the French colonies were falling to the British, and the British armies in the Spanish peninsula, with the Spanish auxiliaries, slowly pressed the French northward. All Europe was getting very weary of Napoleon and very indignant with him. His antagonists now were no longer merely monarchs and ministers, but whole peoples also. The Prussians, after the disaster of Jena in 1806, had set to work to put their house in order. Under the leadership of Freiherr von Stein, they had swept aside their feudalism, abolished privilege and serfdom, reorganized popular education and popular patriotism, accomplished, in fact, without any internal struggle, nearly everything that France had achieved in 1789. By 1810, a new Prussia existed, the nucleus of a new Germany. And now Alexander, inspired, it would seem, by dreams of world ascendancy even crazier than his rivals, was posing again as the friend of liberty. In 1810, fresh friction was created by Alexander's objection to Napoleon's matrimonial ambitions. For he was now divorcing his old helper, Josephine, because she was childless, in order to secure the continuity of his dynasty. Napoleon, thwarted of a Russian princess, snubbed indeed by Alexander, turned to Austria, and married the Archduchess Marie-Louise. The Austrian statesmen read him aright. They were very ready to throw him their princess. By that marriage, Napoleon was captured for the dynastic system. He might have been the maker of a new world. He preferred to be the son-in-law of the old. In the next 2 years, this adventurous affairs crumbled apace. Nobody believed in his pretensions any more. He was no longer the leader and complement of the revolution, no longer the embodied spirit of a world reborn. He was just a new and nastier sort of autocrat. He had estranged all free-spirited men, and he had antagonized the church. Kings and Jacobins were at one when it came to the question of his overthrow. Only base and self-seeking people supported him, because he seemed to have the secret of success. Britain was now his inveterate enemy. Spain was blazing with a spirit that surely a Corsican should have understood. It needed only a breach with Alexander I to set this empire of bluff and stage scenery swaying toward its downfall. The quarrel came. Alexander's feelings for Napoleon had always been of a very mixed sort. He envied Napoleon as a rival and despised him as an underbred upstart. Moreover, there was a kind of vague and sentimental greatness about Alexander. He was given to mystical religiosity. He had the conception of a mission for Russia, and himself to bring peace to Europe and to the world by destroying Napoleon. In that respect, he had an imaginative greatness Napoleon lacked. But bringing peace to Europe seemed to him quite compatible with the annexation of Finland, of most of Poland, and of great portions of the Turkish Empire. This man's mind moved in a luminous fog, and particularly he wanted to resume trading with Britain, against which Napoleon had set his face. For all the trade of Germany had been dislocated, and the mercantile classes embittered by the Napoleonic continental system, which was to ruin Britain by excluding British goods from every country in Europe. Russia had suffered more even than Germany. The breach came in 1811, when Alexander withdrew from the continental system. In 1812, a great mass of armies, amounting altogether to 600,000 men, began to move towards Russia under the supreme command of the new emperor. About half this force was French. The rest was drawn from the French allies and subject peoples. It was a conglomerate army, like the army of Darius, or the army of Cavard. The Spanish War was still going on. Napoleon made no attempt to end it. Altogether, it drained away 250,000 men from France. He fought his way across Poland and Russia to Moscow before the winter. For the most part, the Russian armies declined battle, and even before the winter closed in upon him, his position became manifestly dangerous. He took Moscow, expecting that this would oblige Alexander to make peace. Alexander wouldn't make peace, and Napoleon found himself in much the same position as Darius had been in 2,300 years before in South Russia. The Russians, still unconquered, in a decisive battle, raided his communications, wasted his army, disease helped them. Even before Napoleon reached Moscow, 150,000 men had been lost. But he lacked the wisdom of Darius and would not retreat. The winter remained mild for an unusually long time. He could have escaped. But instead, he remained in Moscow, making impossible plans at a loss. He'd been marvelously lucky in all his previous flounderings. He'd escaped undeservedly from Egypt. He'd been saved from destruction in Britain by the British naval victories. But now he was in the net again, and this time he wasn't to escape. Perhaps he would have wintered in Moscow, but the Russians smoked him out. They set fire to and burnt most of the city. It was late in October. Too late altogether before he decided to return. He made an ineffectual attempt to break through to a fresh line of retreat to the southwest, and then turned the faces of the survivors of his grand army towards the country they had devastated in their advance. Immense distances separated them from any friendly territory. The winter was in no hurry. For a week the grand army struggled through mud. Then came sharp frosts, and then the first flakes of snow, and then snow and snow. Slowly, discipline dissolved. The hungry army spread itself out in search of supplies until it broke up into mere bands of marauders. The peasants, if only in self-defense, rose against them, waylaid them, and murdered them. A cloud of light cavalry, Scythians, still hunted them down. That retreat is one of the great tragedies of history. At last, Napoleon and his staff and a handful of guards and attendants reappeared in Germany, bringing no army with him, followed only by straggling and demoralized bands. The Grand Army, retreating under Murat, reached Königsberg in a disciplined state, but only about 1,000 strong out of 600,000.